Our collective nightmare. The Kennedy Center Honors has always been a ritual, awards, speeches, applause, a safe place for the nation to admire its own soundtracks. This year, the ritual has a new director. President Donald Trump will host the show, announce the winners, and walk the stage like a man who discovered theater while rearranging the executive branch. He skipped these ceremonies his first term. Now he says he was almost entirely involved in picking the honorees and turned away those he judged too woke. He's talked about renaming the place after himself, joked about it at a World Cup event, and presented the medals in the Oval Office like a late-night segment taped in the nation's living room. The list is an oddball parade of vintage America, George Strait, country sales machine, Michael Crawford, the phantom that matches the president's taste in musicals, Sylvester Stallone, who has been promoted from action hero to political emissary, Gloria Gaynor, disco survivor and a donor who quietly crossed into GOP territory, and Kiss, stage pyrotechnics and face paint, their original guitarist having died this year, and his daughter accepting his medal. It is strange and plain at once. The man who ran to tear down institutions is now curating cultural sainthood. He trumpets this class as the greatest ever. While the nation watches a ceremony edited to fit a personal brand, medals are issued in the Oval Office as if honors could be stamped by proximity to power. This is not a merger of art and state. It's a rebranding meeting in which the state buys a ticket, takes the stage and hands out ribbons. Performers who spent careers making audiences feel something are now props in a show about who gets to be anointed by a guy who treats prestige like a campaign event. The broadcast will run on December 23rd. Expect polished camera angles, applause on cue, and the same old American story. Someone with a microphone deciding which versions of us are respectable and which must be excused. The rest of the country will keep clapping because we know how this goes now. Talent, history, and grief packed into a one-hour infomercial for power.
There are real problems, wars, pandemics, climate change, and then there's Indiana snapping a 30-game losing streak against Ohio State and the national trauma that followed. The Hoosiers win their first Big Ten title since 1967, and suddenly half the internet is treating Midwestern euphoria like a stock market correction. Urgent, performative, and somehow everyone's retirement is tied to it. Think about it. A 17-yard pass, a 33-yard conversion to kill the clock, a replay overturn, and a 29-yard field goal that went wide left. That's the emotional arc of an entire fan base for the next decade. Two guys, probably barely old enough to rent a car without a surcharge, are suddenly protagonists in the Heisman soap opera, and we analyze their throws like forensic accountants. Mendoza tweaked something on the first play, missed one snap, came back, and is now being characterized as a gladiator. Gladiators with nil deals. We're outraged by a missed chip shot while countries default on basic infrastructure. We measure victory in seedings and AP votes. A poll of sports writers decides history, and alumni immediately start rebranding diplomas and Instagram bios. Number one, Indiana, reads like a new luxury trim level. And the technology, replay reviews turning inches into existential verdicts. If a 4th-and-1 is reviewed in Indianapolis and no one clips it for a highlight reel, did it even change the economy? Fans spend hours arguing whether the Buckeyes' loss means a plunging dynasty or merely a marketing pivot. Meanwhile, athletic departments quietly reprice parking passes and license plates. The joke isn't the celebration. It's that we can treat a 13-0 football season like national salvation. The real winners are always the ones who sell the jerseys, edit the highlight packages, and trademark the victory chant. The rest of us will keep refreshing bracketology apps between climate reports, because nothing screams first world stability like thinking the fate of civilization rests on a 33-yard pass and a guy named Charlie Becker staying clutch.
The Trump administration spent a week turning Minnesota's Somali community into a national morality play, dehumanizing rhetoric from the president, a federal enforcement surge, a handful of arrests blown up into proof of a crisis, and a chorus of hate mail dropped into mosque inboxes. The spectacle was classic. Pick a scapegoat, publicize a few bad actors, and treat an entire population like a problem to be solved by raids and visas revoked. Minnesota didn't quietly accept its role. State leaders showed up at malls and prayer circles, legislators gave photo ops, and strangers sent notes comparing Somali neighbors to tater tot hot dish, as if casserole analogies can counteract being called less than human. That mix of performative solidarity and real support is noble and a little theatrical, because it runs alongside a federal machine that prefers slogans to nuance. The backstory is familiar and simple. Somalis fled a brutal civil war in the 1990s and found refuge in a state that needed workers and offered social services. Decades later, the community runs businesses, fills public service jobs, and helped elect the country's first Somali congresswoman. When a pandemic-era fraud ring emerged, with most charges against people of Somali descent, national leaders treated that local scandal like a megaphone to amplify old prejudices and justify new crackdowns, including talk of ending temporary protected status. The numbers tell the punchline. DHS announced a dozen arrests and proclaimed victory. Most of the people in Minnesota's Somali neighborhoods remain lawful residents, workers, parents, neighbors. Yet one man in the White House can reduce decades of refuge, work, and civic contribution into a single insult, and federal agents will be dispatched as if that insult were policy. This is not an isolated episode. It's the same play repeated. Demonize a group. Execute a small, noisy operation. Declare triumph. Watch the fear ripple through communities. Locals rally, courts and advocates scramble, and life goes on with an extra layer of suspicion. The absurdity is almost comic if it weren't already a preview of something worse. Governments learning that dehumanizing language and targeted enforcement can be used as tools of governance. Minnesota's Somalis are responding the way people do when the state points a finger at them. They organize. They insist on belonging. They remind the rest of the state that American has never meant one face or one accent. That's hopeful, but hope is a fragile thing when the machinery that separates us from them works on simple slogans and spectacle. The country is practicing a playbook that ends badly, and the intermission feels like it's going to last a very long time.
This piece is based on the Associated Press article titled Pearl Harbor Anniversary. Every year at 7:55 a.m., people on a Hawaiian waterfront fall silent. Fighter jets trace a missing man formation in the sky. One jet peels away to mean someone isn't coming back. Wreaths are laid. Salutes are exchanged. The ritual is tidy. It has a schedule and a sound cue. Once, survivors of the 1941 attack were the reason anyone came. They told stories that smelled of smoke and diesel and the kind of fear words do not always hold. Now there are 12 survivors left, all centenarians, and this year none could make the trip. That's human mortality in an elegant, measurable form. 87,000 present then, a dozen now, a museum soon. There is a peculiar comfort in rituals. They let us perform grief at arm's length. When survivors could attend, ceremonies were rare. Real people nodding to real survivors. Without them, memory becomes curated. Wreaths are presented by active duty sailors. Oral histories are digitized. Museums promise to show the interviews. The Library of Congress has 535 survivor collections. The Park Service has nearly 800 recorded interviews. We record the living so the living will have something to watch when the living are gone. Irony loves ceremonies. We fly a plane formation that pulls one jet away to symbolize absence, then fill that absence with jets, speeches, displays, and the exact choreography of remembrance. We have turned absence into a thing to be scheduled. Some survivors advise practical lessons. Be prepared, one said, as if the moral of catastrophe is logistics. Others wanted the honor of remembering friends and bandmates. Their motives are simple and human: memory, duty, companionship. What we are doing now, as the last eyewitnesses. Fade is both noble and a kind of small fraud. We replace lived experience with recordings and reenactments. We teach descendants to march, to read names, to click links. We hope that will be enough. It might be, or it might be the moment memory becomes a museum exhibit, polite and preserved, removed from the heat of what it once was. Maybe that's how most things end. Not in a blaze, but in a room with good lighting and a helpful caption. We call it remembering. We call it honoring. It's also the human way of refusing silence, arranging it into a program, playing the missing note on cue, and saying with a straight face that the absence has been observed.
The capitalist fever dream. A star designer turns intimacy into inventory. Initials stamped on a necklace promise to keep family close. Hand-painted ceramics carry names like talismans, and a plush throw becomes the universal panacea for acquaintances you barely know. Each object is sold as sentiment. Every sentiment is priced, packaged, and photographed until it can be monetized. Luxury becomes choreography. The pool house is not a refuge, but a white cube substitute. Side Hustle, literally a brand that rents out an atmosphere and calls it a gallery. Commissioned collectible art is detached from public life and sold back to a social class that pays for exclusivity for the private myth of taste. Presentation is product. Wrapping, notes, playlists, tablescapes. The ritual of giving is engineered down to the last sensory cue, so the transaction reads like transcendence. The flatter, aesthetic becomes the value proposition. Narrative and mise-en-scene mask the fact that meaning has been outsourced to designers and influencers. Social proof is the modern seal of approval. Millions of followers and tens of thousands of subscribers are not an audience so much as a ledger. Prospective customers, market research, and free advertising in one scrolling feed. Influence is converted into a distribution channel for curated longing. Personalization is the new intimacy scam. Scratching a name into a teapot or a pendant trades actual closeness for a commodified simulacrum that reassures the buyer, not the recipient. Care becomes craftsmanship you pay for. Tenderness is a bespoke product line. Tradition is repackaged as content. Handmade cards and family rituals exist now as charming counterpoints to a product ecosystem designed to fill loneliness with objects. One item costs nothing, but everything else circulates in a closed economy of taste, where appearance signals moral and economic capital. This is not style, it is supply management for desire. Old soul, new spirit reads like a brand manifesto for nostalgia converted into quarterly revenue. The more everything is curated to speak a single, coherent language, the less it speaks to anyone who isn't buying the vocabulary whole. Underneath the lacquer and the thoughtfulness is a larger rot, the privatization of meaning, the monetization of vulnerability, and the replacement of social life with designed experiences. The fever dream is tidy, beautiful, and deeply transactional, and it tells you exactly what we have traded away.